21st century adaptations and recreating meaning. I begin with an obvious statement. Performances have to make sense to their audience. If the audience can't relate to the characters and the world depicted, the performance is going to fail, and then the play will fail to be re-performed. Sophocles' original tragedy, Trachiniae, translated as Women of Trachis, on which today's performance is based, was intended for a 5th century BC predominantly male Athenian audience, who would have recognised the characters both as humans who carry within themselves the seeds of their own destruction, and as characters from their mythical history, myth being continuous with history for them. This means that there was no avoiding the fact that there was a successful marriage between Heracles' son, Hyllus, and Ialy, Sophocles' entirely silent character, the daughter of Heracles' guest friend, the king of Achaia, whom he killed in order to take her as his war captive mistress and then take her home to his wife. Lovely that! Played this evening as Ialy Gaudenza, the daughter of the until recently sponsor of Heracles' football club. Hyllus and Ialy, though, were the ancestors of the Spartans, so no Hyllus and Ialy, no Sparta. No Sparta, no Helen of Troy. No 300, and perhaps thankfully no Meet the Spartans either. How that is going to be achieved is something that's not fixed, and the original audience would have been paying keen attention to how Sophocles, as an adapter of the myth for the stage, handled it. So you are now, thanks to my spoiler, in exactly the same position as the Athenians with regard to tonight's performance. How is Ialy going to be handled, and how is that going to be achieved? Sophocles' Athenian audience would have recognised the world his tragedy depicted as being one like their own. One in which people gather eagerly in public spaces to hear news about famous people and deeds in faraway places. Where marriages are arranged by parents, where sons obey their fathers, where fate cannot be avoided, where oracles do come true, often in unexpected ways. Husbands and wives fall out, and love causes people to act in extreme and unpredictable ways that mean they end up hurting their friends and their family, rather than obeying the cultural dictum, help your friends, harm your enemies. That world's not unlike our world, but it isn't our world. Which means that while performances of Sophocles' play can be successful, some aspects of it are difficult for us to understand, and this limits its appeal. Thus, Levitt can conclude that Sophocles' Trachiniae has not had anywhere near the popularity as measured either by re-performance or adaptation of the other extant works of Sophocles. Why? Well, there are, I think, two main reasons. One, practical. The budgetary constraints of commercial theatre and the nature of modern theatre spaces has conspired to limit the ability of modern directors to work with a 12 or 15 strong, all singing, all dancing chorus of Women of Trachis. Fortunately, tonight is an exception. Too often the ancient chorus is cut or becomes a single character pushed into a corner of the stage. In the Athenian Theatre, down here on the right, located at the foot of the Acropolis and accommodating about 15,000 people, the chorus occupied the circular area, the orchestra, helpfully translating as dancing place to let us know what they're doing. Hence, in ancient drama, the chorus come in between the audience and the characters to comment on their action, which prevents a modern audience from relating directly to the characters and reminds them very much of their identity as an audience. This compromises the kind of willing suspension of disbelief that has been fostered by cinema and television as much as by the development of theatre practice, although choruses in musical theatre and opera survive and are expected by modern audiences. While in the ancient theatre, it's worth noting that the action takes place outside buildings in which the characters live, and that the theatre is not only an open-air experience on a vast scale, but was, unlike even the Epidavros Ancient Theatre Festival, a daylight experience. Without theatrical lighting, the characters exist in the same light and the same space, breathing the same air as the audience does. The second reason is, as Levitt again notes, in performance, Sophocles' Trachiniae is a game of two halves, well illustrated by KCL's Greek play poster on the right. It's half Deianira, Heracles' wife, and half Heracles. Critical attention to the play, as text, in performance, and in its versions, tends to spend an inordinate amount of time on that. Indeed, critics without a classical background find that the failure of the two characters to share the same stage is a dramatic flaw. This is an example. The two leads are fascinating and rich with substance, complexity, and conflict. The setup of these two great titans consequently creates a promise that in the climax we will meet them face to face. It's what you want to see. The titans bouncing off each other, then put in a bag with the strings tied up to see who comes out on top. But this never happens. Two dots crying out to each other in the night from opposite halves of the play, with minor characters carrying messages back and forth, makes you feel cheated. Makes you wonder, if they'd fixed the fundamental flaws, just how good the play could have been. And adapters spend a lot of time trying to bridge that gap, and you'll see the way in which this has been done this evening is very effective indeed. That fundamental flaw, though, is part of Sophocles' legacy, but it's not one that his original audience would have recognised. For them, the two halves were bridged seamlessly by one male actor taking the parts of both Deianira and Heracles. Now that is an actor's dream come true. The challenge for adapters is to render this material audience-friendly and to work with a modern audience's expectations. And since 2004, they've been rising to this challenge as never before, with the creation of new adaptations and performances of those adaptations ever increasing. This play is speaking to us louder and more often than it has in 2,500 years, and that's not just because, as one critic put it, nodding to Sophocles adds to whatever points you want to make 2,500 years worth of cultural punch. On the other hand, it's legitimate to ask, why bother rising to that challenge? And the answer, I think, lies in the character of Heracles. Here is how Sophocles' tragic theatre audience may have expected to see him. But they're not going to see him in his grandeur in Sophocles. He appears before them only on a litter, in dreadful pain, as the flesh burns from his bones. Fortunately, we see a bit more of him tonight. The Heracles of myth is a superhuman, supermale. The doer of heroic deeds, an explorer of the boundaries of the known world at the time, a slayer of monsters who makes the world a safer place for mere mortals. He is capable of bearing the world on his shoulders, and he attains immortality as a god. Yet he is vulnerable to human failings, to anger, to violence, to love, and to lust. He is the father of numerous children by numerous women, including two wives. Mortal wives. He also gets an immortal wife afterwards. He was a hero, and we are still concerned with what it means to be a hero, and whether those who run faster, jump higher, go further, play better golf, push the boundaries of human capabilities and experience, and become role models, should be permitted to transgress some or any of the norms of human behaviour. In going on, I'm going to mention three adaptations briefly. Firstly, Handel's Heracles, which has a libretto based on Sophocles' Trachiniae and Ovid's Metamorphoses. What I'm going to talk about is its fully staged 2004 production, which was the English language directorial debut of Luc Bondy. It's commonly thought that Crimps, Cruel and Tender was Bondy's English language directorial debut, but it wasn't. It's worth knowing that a 2002 unstaged performance of Handel's Hercules was one of the reasons why Bondy commissioned Crimp to update Sophocles' Trachiniae for the theatre. So my second example is Crimp's Cruel and Tender, which features the general, the Heracles character, whose battle against the hydra-headed monster of terrorism in Africa leads him to genocide and to being made a public scapegoat. That is a play that contributed to the most recent and my final adaptation, the collaboratively scripted Wife of Heracles, that you are going to see tonight. Featuring Thomas Heracles, the footballer, whose libido is an absolute PR nightmare. All of which says something about the 21st century's concept of heroism and the way in which heroes are made and unmade by the media. And that's a theme which goes back to Sophocles. In the opening sequence, Deianira sends Hyllus to seek news of his father, only to find that he already knows some. But it's so far-fetched and out of character that she cannot believe it. Where do they say he is? He's been slave to a Lydian woman. You might hear anything if he put up with even that. Furthermore, all the news is uncertain, as I hear, if we can believe what people say. And it relies on messengers who may have their own axes to grind. There is, in Sophocles, an exception. This is Heracles' official herald, who is supposed, on pain of having his tongue cut out, because heralds have to tell the truth, to tell the truth. But it appears during the course of the play that he has lied. He's told Deianira that he doesn't know who Ely is. But he's challenged by the messenger to tell her, as he told the citizens of Trachis, that Heracles wants Ely for his wife. Whereupon he makes the wonderful statement, "Well, yes, I said that I had heard it, but it is not the same thing to say what you think is true and to give a definite account." So at that point you might like to look out for the journalist Alicia and Heracles' PR manager Rhea tonight and see how they handle this. I'm only going to look very briefly at two aspects of those adaptations, the titles and the substance given to Heracles that wounds him terribly. In terms of the titles, Trachiniae, Women of Trachis, is usually billed as belonging to Sophocles, regardless of the translation used. This plays to classically aware audiences who can identify the location. Here we are, in Trachis, quite a long way away from Heracles' hometown of Thebes, which means that the entire cast, with the exception of the messenger and the chorus, are displaced persons, so they have that in common. Hercules, on the other hand, is a Latinized form of Heracles. It emphasizes the classical origins, focuses the attention on the central character, and identifies him as a Roman hero. We don't even find out he's in Trachis till Act 3, and any displacement is elided by the convincingly Roman world portrayed. It was set by Bondi in a sand-floored arena amidst the fragments of a statue of Hercules. During the 15-month absence that has preceded the action, it appears that his legend has been damaged. But the damage is not irreparable, as the statue, as he returns, is built up, and as he becomes a god, is made whole again. The rebuilding is part of a rehabilitation and a sanitization of Hercules, who is, in this version, a loyal husband. His wife's suspicion is unjust, it is unfounded. He has destroyed Ely's city through ambition, martial ambition, not lust, just like he destroyed the city of Troy. He hasn't laid a finger on her. But as not only Ely, but both Heracles himself, some villain has belied me, and nature, the moon would be blotted from his orb before he played false. We've had no lunar eclipse. Heracles is true to his wife. Cruel and tender, on the other hand, doesn't signal any origins, but it does indicate the play's emotional complexity and that of its characters. The displacement is captured by Richard Peduzzi's set. It's a bland, anonymous, institutional feeling yet luxury hotel suite. It's disturbed by the sound of jets from the nearby airport. As in Sophocles, the audience only sees the general in extremis. He is on the right, behind his son Hyllus, unfortunately, it's the only shot I've got. He's catheterized and he's wheelchair bound, but he's still protesting his heroic identity, saying things like, "I have purified the world for you. I have burnt terror out of the world for people like you." And ending, "I am not the criminal, but the sacrifice," as he's led away, and by that point the waters have been so muddied that we haven't got a clue whether that's actually true or not. And it was noted that this was a very timely reminder that the first casualty in war is in fact truth. The wife of Heracles indicates its classical origin and signals the increased stage time and centrality of that character in her own right and in relation to others. It also makes explicit her subordination to her husband in previous versions, implying a new emphasis in the handling of the material. That she's still subordinated to him is indicated by not using her name. But this also makes it more accessible to a theatre-going audience. how many potential theatre-goers would recognise or could pronounce Dianera, and how many might be expecting, courtesy of Walt Disney, to find themselves meeting Meg. Moving on then to substance use and abuse. I'm going to look at the substance used by Dianera, its origin, its administration, and the question of her guilt. In Sophocles, what we have is the blood of Nessus, a centaur who earned his living ferrying passengers across a river. So updating him tonight to a chauffeur is entirely appropriate. Sophocles' story is that Nessus assaulted Dianera and was killed by Heracles, who shot him with one of his hydra-poison-tipped arrows. Nessus, thanks in this depiction to being on the opposite side of the river from Heracles, has time to tell Dianera that the blood from his wound will prevent Heracles ever loving another woman. And she naively understands that that means it's a love charm. Wouldn't the existence of the poison arrows give her a clue that it might be fatal? I do have the feeling she might be a bit stupid here. After Iole's arrival, Dianera applies it to a garment, which in Sophocles she gives to a servant, Heracles' herald, to give to Heracles. She then discovers that the blood is highly corrosive and fears the worst but does not act. After that, their son Hyllus accuses her of his father's murder and she kills herself. In Handel, we also have a garment dipped in the blood of the centaur Nessus. But Broughton avoids us wondering if Dejanira is stupid by Nessus giving the garment that he has previously soaked in his blood to her and telling her to prevail on Heracles to wear it to prove its magic power. She bids the same servant, Lycas, to take it to Heracles as a pledge of love's renewal. She realises what she's done only after it is announced that Heracles has been poisoned by it and she's grief-stricken. But at the point when Heracles becomes a god, her sanity is restored. But at that point, I'm damn sure I'm not wearing any fabric called Herculon. Crimp, after that, ups the stakes. It's a biological weapon. It's called humane. It eradicates warlike characteristics. It was given to Amelia, the Dianera character, by her former lover, conveniently a research chemist. But alas, she abandoned him for the general. Amelia hides a glass phial of humane in a pillow and coerces a government minister into giving it to the general. Confronted with the effect by their son, she admits that she knew it could cause physical damage. Sending it was part of her refusal to be a victim. I could be mistaken for a victim, and that's not a part I'm prepared to play, she says. She commits suicide. This means that substances have to be believably capable of restoring Heracles' love and believably capable of killing him, and that substances can be used in all innocence by a Dianera, used in full knowledge of their toxic capabilities and or suspected of toxicity by both Dianera and the audience. Tonight's solution is fantastic and had me as an Agatha Christie reader on tenterhooks from its first mention. The substance is a foxglove liqueur. In other words, a highly alcoholic suspension of digitalis. It's a tincture that may be, 40 to 90% proof. Digitalis is a heart medication that's been used as a poison for centuries. It was given to Dianera by the chauffeur Nessus, with whom she has a close professional relationship, which may have been a full-blown affair, and whom Hyllus, for one, thinks raped her. Whatever the truth, Nessus had been beaten to death by Heracles, and Dianera gives the liqueur to their son to give to his father, as a reminder of how strongly Heracles feels about her and what he has done for love of her. She discovers the liqueur is a poison and attempts to prevent its delivery. Having failed, she commits suicide. And Heracles exhibits all the symptoms of advanced digitalis poisoning, including hallucinations, very graphically depicted. While watching, pay attention to the hints about the toxicity and the alcohol content of this tincture. You might also like to know that there are documented cases of foxglove being mistaken for comfrey and killing those who drink it as tea. It has put me right off foxglove-branded wine. But I still wonder whether Deianira should have known better. And I'm still unsure why she trusted Nessus to give her something that might help her in her relationship with another man. So tonight's adaptation is supremely successful in recreating the uncertainty of the Sophoclean original in an age that doesn't use love potions. And it reminds us that we may never be certain what the truth is, and encourages us to go and watch very closely indeed. Thank you very much.